We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program Sheila Kolhatkar. She's a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. Her new book, Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Wanted Man on Wall Street. This book, of course, is about Stephen A. Cohen of SAC, I guess, Capital. Sheila, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right. So, I mean, for folks who don't know what a hedge fund is, give us a sense of what a hedge fund is and where it fits in terms of the broader Wall Street, I guess, as an institution.
Well, hedge funds really started many decades ago, and they were originally conceived to be these boutique investment pools for very wealthy investors where they could park sort of a piece of their money, and it would be shielded from swings in the market because the hedge fund manager would be buying stocks, and they would also be shorting stocks, which is betting against the stocks. It's sort of a risky activity that most investors don't do. So that's how they started this little boutique service. They charge very high fees, very lightly regulated because they were only taking money from very wealthy, sophisticated investors. And what happened over the last few decades is they were so enormously successful at sort of exploiting the market, exploiting any information advantage they could have in their investing. And over time, you know, they the most successful ones were posting returns year after year of 30, 40, 50%. The people running these hedge funds became enormously wealthy and powerful, and some of the funds grew into the multi-billion dollars. So they're actually now a very strong influence in the market. People don't even realize it, but many of the newest billionaires who have been created over the last few decades are hedge fund managers. Stephen A. Cohen is one. Robert Mercer, who's Donald mm-hmm. Trump's primary financial backer, is another very good example of this. Paul Singer, Bill Ackman, and many of these people have so much money now that they, they're exerting a lot of influence in politics, and their funds are so large, or these huge pools of private capital, that they can actually take big stakes in public companies and sort of direct those companies to do what they wish. They do a lot of lobbying in Washington, and it's sort of the first time we've seen this scale of wealth created for a group of people who actually, you know, didn't build companies that actually made products. They employ relatively few people. And they do bring liquidity to the market, which means that they do help kind of drive stock prices to more realistic levels because they're in there trading every day. But, you know, a lot of people don't understand what value they really bring to the economy.
I mean, do they really bring any significant value to the economy? I mean, what is your sense of that? I mean, you used to work as a hedge fund. You've been writing about them. We can talk about the broader financialization and products and the financialization of our economy. But, I mean, for the billions of dollars that they create for themselves, short of, you know, maybe some landscaping outfits in Greenwich, and the local building supply stores, what, and maybe not even local, right? I mean, Italian marble that they're flying into Greenwich. But can you really point to a large benefit, even commensurate with the wealth that they've made to the broader economy?
I think it is hard to make the argument that they have really contributed as much as they have taken out. Now, I will say, in their defense, their argument would be, well, we manage money for a lot of pension funds, and that's true. Pension funds, especially as they become under more pressure to find returns to pay for retiree benefits and so on, a lot of them have piled into hedge funds. Some of them have made a lot of money through hedge fund investments. Many of them have lost money too. So, you know, that argument is a bit mixed. There's some small faction of the hedge fund world that has played a very active role in detecting frauds in the market. And Enron is a very famous example. The sort of the widespread fraud at Enron was first detected by a hedge fund. So some of them are incentivized to kind of research really intensively and scope out problems at companies that are lying about their earnings. That is a very positive role. But it's true that at the same time, a lot of their compensation is taxed at a much lower rate than people who are earning salaries. And, many of the most successful hedge fund managers are very involved in lobbying for even lower taxes. This is a big issue for a lot of them. And they create relatively few jobs when you compare it to the money that they're generating every year. So I think it is a tough argument. And, now we're seeing a lot of them really having an impact on big public companies in the U.S., and it's not always positive. And most recently, a hedge fund took a big stake in Whole Foods. And you can kind of predict what that hedge fund is going to tell Whole Foods to do. It's going to tell them to reduce their employees.
Well, wait a second. Let me stop before we get to that, because yeah. I just want to talk about, when we hear about the carried interest tax loophole. This is who we're talking about, right? I mean, this is not even capital gains versus wage tax difference, right? I mean, this isn't the run of the mill. We value money. The money you make from money over the money that you make from actually working. This is even goes beyond that, right? Tell people what the carried interest tax loophole is.
Yeah, well, so that carried interest tax applies mainly to hedge fund and private equity fund partnerships. And it is a much lower tax rate that is intended, at least in theory, to incentivize investment. And, of course, we want to motivate job creators or business financers to invest money in businesses and job creation. But in fact, what ends up happening is that at the end of the year, hedge fund managers typically, most of their compensation comes from a 20%, sometimes 50% cut of the profits generated by their fund each year. And a lot of people would argue that, that money, whatever investments they had, those were not really risks they were taking to finance businesses. Those were kind of passive stakes in companies by holding their shares or whatever it was. And a lot of that money, which can add up to hundreds of millions of dollars for the most successful, biggest hedge fund managers, ends up being taxed at this 15% rate, which is much lower than certainly the rate that I pay and most people I know. And it seems unfair. And it's remarkable to see all the flip-flopping that goes on. I mean, everyone who goes into Washington seems to argue that this is an unfair tax rate, but they're unable to kind of do anything about it. And that must be
unwilling, I think it's probably more accurate. I mean, they are certainly able to. They decide not to because they're getting their funding there. I mean, so there is no, in other words, there's not even a pretense really with that money that you're building anything any more than one could argue I'm investing in people's jobs by going to Vegas and losing money at the blackjack table or making money at the blackjack table. I mean,
there may be some small percentage of their investment that falls legitimately into that category, but it's a small subset. And,
right.
And most of the money they're making, really, it is just inexplicable to me why it would not be taxed at the same rate as everyone else.
All right. So that's so we have a sense of who hedge funders are. But and before we get into the story of Stephen Cohen, and I'm fascinated by how much his story is an anomaly or is really just sort of on a spectrum or a matter of degree in terms of what the hedge funder business model is. But within the context of the 2008 financial crisis, which we associate specifically with investment bankers and the mortgage industry, and where do they fit in that taxonomy on Wall Street? I mean, where do hedge funders, bump up against like Goldman Sachs or selling derivatives or securities?
Well, I think hedge funds, as they became these larger, much more powerful influences in the market, they kind of taught everyone else on Wall Street about the value and the incredible money that could be made through this sort of short-term speculation that a lot of them were involved in. And during the period I kind of chart in the book through Steve Cohen's career, I mean, he went from being this little day trader. Eventually, he was trading so much that, you know, Goldman Sachs, all the big banks were desperately competing for his business and doing anything they could to please him. And I think this kind of mindset spread to all of those big banks. And now you really cannot blame hedge funds for the mortgage crisis. However, they were major clients of these banks that were creating securities based on mortgage products. Without the hedge fund demand for those investments, it's hard to believe that the crisis would have been quite on the scale that it was. And very famously, John Paulson, who's a very, you know, prominent hedge fund manager, he was investing in against mortgages, so he was having a bank like Goldman pick subprime mortgages that he had researched and thought would go down, and then he was betting against them, and then the bank wasn't necessarily telling the other people on the other side of those bets how that whole thing had been constructed. So they were in there, they played a role, but they certainly aren't responsible for that. But what I thought was sort of interesting through sort of the period that I cover in the book was that while that whole mortgage fraud bubble really blew up, the government was also investigating insider trading, which had spread among many hedge funds, and they were getting company information and sort of buying it and sharing it amongst themselves and making a lot of money. All of this coincided with a very kind of heavy deregulation period in Washington, and I just think it's not a coincidence that all of this happened while Washington was focused on deregulating Wall Street. And the SEC was specifically sort of told not to be aggressive about pursuing financial crime.
And just the ethos, I guess, and the modus operandi is what sort of contaminated the broader Wall Street.
Well, very short-term thinking. And I mean, there are thousands of hedge funds, and they all have their own strategies, but there's a pretty big group, subset of them, which are, and Steve Cohen was one of these, they're sort of short-term event-driven hedge funds. So mm-hmm. what they're trying to do is make bets on earnings announcements or drug trial results or mergers, things that they kind of know or expect are going to happen, and they want to research, they want to learn and kind of predict the outcome of this event and then make a bet on it and make money off of it. So they're all just focused on the next few hours, days, weeks. They are not long-term investors like Warren Buffett, where you're taking a stake in the company and you're kind of aligned with the interests of the company. You want it to grow over time. They really don't care, right? They just want to make a trade. And that was so successful for some of them that I think everyone just started to try and do the same thing.
And we should say, so that there are no hard feelings, hashtag not all hedge funders, if that makes people feel, more comfortable. But when you talk about that short-term interest, that misaligned interest between the hedge funders making money and the best interests of the company that they're involved with, that's what, when you talk about Whole Foods and you talk about hedge funders coming in and looking for a quarter by quarter increase in profits, which will drive the value of the stock up, even if it means like we're going to cut employees and you won't notice the drop in service or the drop in quality of our product for a couple of years, but by the time you do, we'll have made all our money and we'll be on to the next thing. I mean, that's basically, that hedge funding strategy is basically a larger problem within our economy, across the board.
Yes. I mean, something I say frequently to people is that this idea that companies are only beholden to their shareholders and that a company has to do whatever it has to do to please its shareholders and move its stock price up every quarter is a new idea, and it wasn't always so. And there are other stakeholders who have an interest in a company's health and performance over time, such as the employees, such as the customers, the communities. All of these people have some interest in how that company does and the decisions it makes. But over time, over a period that's coincided with this rise of sort of really aggressive, powerful short-term investing, you have companies focus more and more on placating their shareholders. And when you have these individuals, very smart, aggressive, kind of empowered hedge fund moguls with billions of dollars at their disposal. They're all very competitive with one another. They can take a huge stake in a company, and that really gives them this very powerful voice. And in some cases, they end up really driving the company through various measures to take steps that are maybe, you know, generating profit for the shareholders in the short term. But of course, over time, we see it, you know, blowing up, or exactly what you said. I mean, by the time you notice that they've swapped out the products to these much cheaper formulations made in China, the hedge fund investors made his or her money and they're gone.
And we should say, too, when we talk about shareholders, usually some of the biggest shareholders, aside from these hedge fund raiders, are the CEO and the board of directors, who also, and maybe, you know, a couple other people in the C-suite who have their own sort of cottage industry that they're running, that whose incentive structure is slightly misaligned from the long-term health of the company. But let's turn to your story, which is, you know, where, you know, I mean, I think arguably Stephen A. Cohen is, you know, I don't want to say patient zero, but I mean, similar, right? Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, I was really interested in him because he was one of the most successful kind of pioneers of the hedge fund industry. And he was a very middle-class guy, very smart, scrappy, grew up in Long Island, went to Wharton. And he knew from early on that he wanted to be rich. He wanted to have more money than his parents, who were a little stretched financially. So Wall Street embraced him, and he started his hedge fund, SAC Capital, in 1992. And his timing was fortuitous, and it happened to be the exact moment that our society aligned itself, for whatever reason, to reward this kind of speculative trader job more richly than almost any other job you could find. So very quickly, he became a billionaire just through this sort of short-term momentum trading, what we would call day trading. And over time, you know, all the Wall Street banks started to kind of cater to him. They would give him their best information. They would do anything they could to get his business. He was enormously powerful. And then in the mid-2000s, the FBI embarked on this big crackdown on illegal trading in the hedge fund industry. And very quickly, their investigation, you know, they were flipping people and wiretapping hedge fund traders. Very quickly, this whole thing coalesced around SAC, Mr. Cohen's fund. And
give us a sense of the timing specifically. And it was a function of, like, this guy was getting regularly 30% annual returns, and that set off some alarm bells.
Right. Well, for years, everyone on Wall Street would point to SAC Capital as this incredible success story. They had never had, this is by 2013, they had never had a down year. They had only had one down year, 2008, which was the heat of the financial crisis, and everyone had a down year. But aside from that, they were posting these phenomenal returns, 30, 40, 50% year after year. No one could really understand how they were doing it, even if Steve Cohen was the greatest trader of his generation, which he may well have been. That is still just an odds-defying performance record. So all of his competitors were suspicious. And around 2004, 5, 6, the FBI started to figure out that actually, you know, they really had no idea what these hedge funds were up to. They had become very large, and the FBI securities unit had been focused on these sort of small Ponzi schemes and kind of Wolf of Wall Street little CD cases. And they realized, okay, well, there's this huge and unregulated industry managing trillions of dollars. We need to figure out what's going on. So they started to look into it, and they discovered that a lot of hedge fund traders and analysts were paying executives at public companies, especially tech companies, to get information about their earnings, for example, or their new products before the rest of the market. They were getting material non-public information. They were paying for it, and they were making millions of dollars trading it. And a lot of their evidence pointed them towards SAC. You know, every little guy they kind of busted or approached said, well, you think I'm bad, you should check out what SAC Capital is doing. So they, you know, they ended up devoting a lot of resources to investigating that firm.
And tell us a story. I mean, so Stephen Cohen, they ultimately don't bring charges against him. They bring the charges against his company. But before we get there, tell us a story of, just to give people a sense of the lengths that they would go with to get information. And tell us a story of Matthew Martoma and Sid Gillman, and also how Martoma and others who got information, maybe through this way or other ways, would communicate this information to Cohen.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I thought was very interesting about this world and submerging myself into it was just that how many incredibly kind of accomplished Ivy League, you know, best and brightest young men, they were mostly men, were working as analysts and portfolio managers of these hedge funds, a lot of them at SAC, and they honestly were spending their days trying to figure out what a company's earnings would be within a penny. That was what they were devoting their mental energy to, and they were getting paid very richly for figuring it out correctly. And I thought that was just a very weird misallocation of intellectual capital in our economy, because these are people who could have done really, you know, interesting things in other fields, but this is what they chose to do.
They could have been writing sitcoms if they came.
They could have been writing sitcoms. They could have been curing cancer. Who knows? But they, you know, they could have been teachers, but they wanted to make a lot of money, and this was the fastest way they could do it. So there they are on the phone all day, running around, trying to figure out, okay, Dell is reporting earnings in 2 weeks. Is it going to be a penny above or a penny below what people expect? I mean, it's sort of an insane job.
And Sheila, did they have a... Was there an algorithm that if it is, let's say, a penny below, we can anticipate the stock dropping X percent, and so we go in and we can short it in such a way, or take a position that we can take advantage of that small, we can arbitrage that small difference? Is that basically what the theory was?
Basically. I mean, in addition to figuring out what was going to happen, they also had to figure out what the market was expecting, because the stock's response to a piece of news is always based on what the market had expected to happen. So if there's a surprise for the market, that is the most valuable thing to figure out. If it's going to beat its earnings estimate and everyone's expecting it to perform poorly, then that's really valuable. If you figure out something and everyone else kind of knows it as well, it's going to be hard to make a good bet. So yes, that's basically what they were doing. And
would they zero in on companies that there was a sort of a conventional wisdom about, and then try and find something that was different?
Well, it sort of depended. I mean, they certainly love to do this a lot with volatile stocks like tech stocks and biotech stocks, which could move wildly based on even small pieces of news. Largely because there were so many hedge funds trading the stocks. I mean, they would just swing up and down like crazy. They would have to pick their targets very carefully. And this is why they had all these smart, I mean, increasingly math majors are going into this field. Math and computer programming skills are very valuable. And, the hedge funds have so many resources, so much money to spend, that they would then go and do all sorts of things, creative things, to try and figure out what this news was going to be, to get this information. And yes, it was easy to cross the line. And Matthew Martoma, who was convicted ultimately, I mean, he went to work for Steve Cohen in 2006, and he was a biotech kind of industry expert, a graduate of Duke and Stanford Business School. And he, over time, ended up cultivating...
He lied that he was from Harvard, too, though, didn't he?
Well, he did attend Harvard, but he ended up being expelled from Harvard Law School because he had falsified his transcripts. I mean, this all came out later. So he was a very complicated fellow with a troubled background, but he did still have this kind of Ivy League pedigree, and he was very determined, and he got to SAC. He was a portfolio manager, which meant he had a little pool of money he was responsible for managing. He had his analysts and traders working for him, and he was also responsible for giving good trading ideas to Steve Cohen, his boss, and that's how SAC was structured. There were these competing groups of portfolio managers who all were out there researching ideas every day, and part of their job was to feed their best ideas up the food chain to Cohen, who was also trading his own money. So there's a lot of pressure on these people and a lot of money to be made if they came up with good ideas. And Martoma spent months cultivating a relationship with a doctor, Dr. Sid Gilman, who was involved in a very high-profile Alzheimer's drug trial. And, you know, there were two public pharmaceutical companies testing this new drug. There were high hopes for the drug. Alzheimer's has no cure, obviously. It's a devastating disease. So anyone who figured out a cure for this disease was going to make a ton of money. So there were all these hedge funds in there trying to make money off of this drug trial and figure out what was going to happen and bet the right way. And these stocks of these companies were almost entirely driven by expectations about this drug. And over time, according to the government's allegations, Martoma ended up kind of corrupting this doctor into sharing the results with him before they were public. And this was a very big deal. And during Martoma's trial, the government presented this whole scenario where, you know, they had all sorts of flight records and documents that, you know, showing that Martoma had flown to the University of Michigan, where the doctor was a research chair, and had viewed this drug trial presentation on his computer, then got back on a plane back to Connecticut. And then the following morning, which was a Sunday morning, he had a phone call with Steve Cohen, his boss. And then the next week, Monday, SAC Capital started liquidating its holdings in these two stocks. And they ended up selling almost $1 billion worth of shares of these two drug companies and then shorting them. So that happened over the next week. And then a few days later, Dr. Gilman presented the trial results publicly, and the stocks plunged because the trial was a huge disappointment. The market was shocked. And SAC Capital was alleged to have made $275 million.
Mm. And now, how did there was also, and we should say, like, whenever there was these instances, I mean, this isn't an example of one, but throughout that, the Cohen would have this system of, like, what was it called? Conviction scale or
rating.
Something like that? Rating? Yeah, just explain that, because it's pretty amazing that this guy got away without any charges being brought against him, because somehow by the magic of, I mean, the idea that Martoma could have convinced Stephen Cohen to make these decisions and didn't bring up the fact that, like, hey, I've been going and meeting with this guy for months. And he's given me inside information. The idea that that didn't come up in the conversation seems really hard to swallow.
Most people who read the book and the story are really stunned by the outcome and the fact that Steve Cohen ultimately, I mean, he pays a big fine, but nothing really happens to him.
It's not really that big of a fine, right? I mean,
well, relative, yeah.
It's 10% of his value, 10% of everything he made in that business.
Yeah, in the end, his total fines were $1.8 billion. So yes, maybe 10%. I mean, it's fair to say that it did not dent his life at all. He just wrote a check for that money. I mean, that's how rich he is. And you know, to some extent, I think the fact that it ended the way it did, and it is so sort of shocking to people's sense of right and wrong, is what makes it a story of our time, because we increasingly live in a time when those at the very top remain insulated from what's going on, even though they are reaping the profits. And this is an increasing issue in our society, obviously. But you know, it really came down to a variety of factors. But you know, there was this very dramatic showdown in 2013 between the government and Steve Cohen's lawyers. And his lawyers, he of course spent unlimited millions of dollars on the best defense team you could possibly have. Many of them were former prosecutors and SEC regulators. And they all went down to the U.S. Attorney's office in Manhattan. Preet Bharara was still the Manhattan U.S. Attorney at this time. And they attended this, you know, they did this four-hour presentation for the government. And their goal was to convince them not to charge Cohen. And you know, reading about it later, it's sort of almost comical, because a lot of their argument rests on, oh, he didn't read emails, he didn't know, he doesn't recall what was said. you know, he they brought up this conviction rating idea because, of course, Cohen's analysts were taught to present ideas to him with a number attached from 1 to 10. And if it had a 10, it meant you had 100% conviction in the idea. And this ended up insulating him in some cases from whatever it was the person had done to become so certain. So even though it seems baffling that someone could say, well, I'm 100% sure that this X event is going to happen in the future, I mean, it sort of seems impossible, this did sort of protect him on some level from knowing the dirty details. And in the end, the government concluded that they did not have enough evidence to be confident that they would win if they took him to trial. And they were, you know, possibly scared of losing, but also, I think, trying to be principled and not push forward on something that they felt was probably right if they didn't have the evidence. And the ending is very unsatisfying for a lot of people.
How much of, I mean, there was a lot of, like, these cases, you know, I mean, obviously, there was a lot of these cases around that era because that was the nature of the era. We've talked about Sam Israel on this program as well, which was a far more a blatant fraud, and obviously Madoff and others. But how much of what Stephen Cohen's business model was, I mean, how much of it crossed the line, do you think? I mean, if this guy's getting 30% returns and, one of his people, Mertoma, you know, it's not like, hey, I went out last night and I happened to meet somebody at a bar and I pretended like I was friends with him for a couple of hours. We got really drunk and he told me about this Alzheimer's thing. I mean, this is a completely premeditated, long-term, I mean, you're talking over the course of months, right? A long-term project. If you're working for Stephen Cohen and you're engaging in this type of work to get this type of information, to give him a number 9 or a number 10 on the conviction rating, which I think it's reasonable to assume that at one point, you know, maybe in the commissary, Cohen just says, like, if you're ever, if you ever develop a personal relationship with someone and you're, you know, and specifically to get this information, it's insider information, that's a 9 or a 10. You know, I mean, depending on if you've actually slept with them or whatever it is that was the measure, right? I mean, so how much of that business is that?
It's hard to say. I mean, my sense from having spent so many months just really deeply reporting on Steve Cohen's background, his career, I think he was a very, very talented trader. I wouldn't necessarily call him an investor, which implies some kind of longer term, you know, investing strategy. He was a trader. He was a guy who could recognize momentum in the market and, you know, make trades. And he was very, you know, he wasn't scared of losing money. A lot of people are crippled by fear who do that job. I mean, he was really one of a kind in some respects. I am sure that he would have been very, very successful without any of that stuff going on at his firm. And he was also, he was a very smart businessman in some respects, and he did kind of evolve his hedge fund in clever ways as the market changed, and he was very successful at all that. But, it's hard to quantify.
Right.
Ultimately, more than 8 people were linked to insider trading in some way. Several pled guilty or were convicted. One person had his conviction reversed later.
And nobody flipped.
So it's hard to say. People who were lower down flipped. But, you know, the FBI tried very hard to get someone who was close to Cohen, who was senior in the company, to flip. They really spent a lot of energy on that, and they just hit a wall and could not go any further. And I think that is ultimately why the case resolved the way it did. They just reached a certain point and then they got stuck. And Mertoma was really, the one they had expected to deliver a case to them. I mean, Mertoma refused to flip and he is now serving a 9-year prison sentence in Florida. He's appealing his case, although no one seems super optimistic about that from his perspective. But, that's largely why the case ended as it did.
Right. There are people who toil away for more than 10 years at horrible jobs and don't come out and expect to get millions of dollars of reward, which I imagine he suspects is waiting for him on the other end. But who knows? All right. Lastly, let me ask you this. How much of the FBI's pursuit? I mean, I understand the motivations of federal prosecutors and FBI agents who are in this division and who look for this type of stuff. Obviously, the Southern District of Manhattan, this is where this stuff happens. And I'm not doubting the intensity and the sort of the sincerity of pursuit of these guys. But how much at the next level up, at the, you know, in the DOJ, how much of going after guys like this for insider trading and for, you know, for the stuff that you can just sort of peg as like, you know, that's the, you know, the criminal, the fraudsters. How much of the pursuit of that was a function of this will be much showier and we don't have to go after the banks for the stuff that went on in bringing about the financial crisis?
Well, a lot of people do rightfully point out that they did do all this insider trading, prosecution, and very little on the banks, and people are rightfully very frustrated about that. I do like to remind people that the insider trading stuff started actually before the financial crisis hit. I mean, those cases were all kind of in the pipeline before 2007. So I think they did do the right thing by seeing it through. However, it's true that at some point they were stretched for resources and they had to make decisions about who was going to work on what. Now, I strongly believe they could have pursued insider trading and big bank mortgage fraud at the same time. I'm sure that was possible. It didn't happen. I do get the sense that at some point, all of these victories and all of these sort of flattering articles in the newspaper about pre-Barrera's, you know, 80-0 perfect record on insider trading, I'm sure that felt pretty good. And if you're in, you know, if you're the person benefiting from all that, I mean, do you really want to pull the plug on that and turn to an area that's much less certain in terms of outcome? I mean, insider trading cases, people sometimes say, oh, they're so easy. I would disagree. Having studied what went into these cases, they're very difficult, often lead to dead ends. But
they're,
you know,
a lot less
huge,
politically complicated.
They're more straightforward. They don't involve taking on huge institutions. Hedge funds are more independent, you know, perhaps lower hanging fruit on some level. Those big bank cases were probably daunting, trying to figure out all that collateralized debt obligation stuff, you know, and there probably would have been a large number of investigations that did not yield cases. And that's always tough because who wants to spend months of their career? These are often young prosecutors, ambitious young people from Ivy League law schools, trying to make names for themselves, and one can sympathize with that. But, you know, someone should have made a decision to commit the resources, and it didn't happen. And I think we are still paying the price politically for that.
Did his initials, was his initials EH by any chance?
I think there are several people who share share the blame, but he might be on the list, yes.
Sheila Kolhatkar, the book is Black Edge, Inside Information, Dirty Money, and the Quest to Bring Down the Most Man, a Wanted Man on Wall Street. It's a great read. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It was great to be here.